Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In Animate, a new book, acclaimed science writer Michael Bond explores how animals have profoundly influenced our minds and cultures. Drawing on cutting-edge insights from psychology, anthropology, literature, and neuroscience, he traces the varied ways their lives have affected ours. Scientists today are challenging the assumption that we are separate from and superior to animals, showing that they too possess intelligence, empathy, creativity, even the ability to use tools. So if everything that supposedly makes us human is shared with other creatures, where does that leave us? And if we're not as exceptional as we thought, how should we be treating the animals we live alongside? Michael Bond is the author of Wayfinding, The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. He's a writer specializing in human behavior, former editor and reporter at New Scientist. He won the 2015 British Psychological Society Prize for The Power of Others. He is currently teaching and writing as a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at Oxford Brookes University. He joins us today. Michael Bond, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. You're speaking to me from England somewhere?
From Hampshire, the English countryside. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's
middle great. Of the afternoon.
The magic of Zoom. Good to reach you here in
for
Utah.
Sure.
Why this book? Why this topic?
Well, it feels like a good time to think about how we relate to animals and how our relationship with animals has changed over the years. At a time today when we're in something of an ecological crisis. And the other reason is that lately there have been a lot of interesting studies on animal cognition and emotions and consciousness, suggesting that we have somewhat undermined the qualities of our fellow creatures. So it seemed like it's a good time to dig into that science.
So the title, it could be Animate or Animate. I guess it's always good when you can have different interpretations of a title.
Yeah, it could be either. And the idea of the title is really just to evoke the sort of bustle and drama of the living world, and also this idea that other creatures are often present in our minds.
So let's go back in history, way back. You write that there was a change for eons. Our ancestors depicted animals one way, but then there's a change in the Neolithic. So remind us when the Neolithic was.
Yeah. So this is the time when our ancestors started to settle and sort of moving around, hunting and gathering, developed agriculture. This was about 8,000 years ago, the beginning of the Neolithic. Prior to that, it looks as if human relationships with animals was very different, more intimate, perhaps more reverential. We know that solely because of the paintings on the inside of caves that have been discovered, largely in southern Europe, from the period 40,000 years ago to about 10,000 years ago. And there's an extraordinary number of these paintings which animals depicted in extraordinary detail, with great skill. And so we know something about how our ancestors at that time thought about animals. And then at the beginning of the Neolithic, the way that animals were depicted in art changed quite fundamentally. Instead of the sort of reverential treatment, you see pictures, murals of animals being taunted or baited and ultimately domesticated. So that marks a kind of fundamental change in the way people seem to have regarded animals.
And it's a change you say is not, I guess, not healthy. You're pushing back against that change in this book.
Well, I mean, part of the idea of the book is to explore how that changed happened and how it developed. Through the Neolithic, the period of the early period of domestication, animals began to be seen as objects of use, things that humans could exploit. And that continued and really became a sort of intellectual exercise in the early Greek civilization, say around 2,500 years ago, at the time of Aristotle. And Aristotle, the philosopher, talked about animals lacking the sort of rational thinking, a rational soul that humans possess. And thereafter, humans were thought to be separate from the natural world, different to animals, superior in many ways.
Descartes really took this to an extreme. He felt animals were just machines, essentially.
Yeah, sure. So through the Middle Ages, this progressed, and then you come to Descartes, who talked about animals as really just being subject to the movements of their own bodies and their sensations, and not sharing any of the kind of rational thought, the morality, the emotional ability of humans. So that idea of animals as machines, it persisted really right up to into the 20th century.
Hmm. Tell me a little bit more about theology, how theologians viewed this. I guess that it became prevalent theology that animals couldn't be sacred. Animals could not have a soul.
That's right. This is another way that animals were depicted as being different to humans, and that they were never considered to have a sort of a spirituality, a sacredness, and were certainly not thought to be able to enter the kingdom of heaven. This was true really in all Western religions. It's slightly different in Eastern religions, where the dynamic between animals and humans is slightly different. But so you have intellectuals, philosophers, and theologians really promoting this idea of humans as a superior species and animals lacking many of the qualities that define us.
So how did this affect us then? Obviously, I guess this was detrimental to animals. If you don't see they have a soul, if you see them as totally other, you can mistreat them more easily. What about us? How did this affect us?
Well, this was driven. This whole sort of philosophy, this intellectual approach, was really driven not so much by any credible observations of animal behavior or animal cognition, but really by our own psychology. This need for humans to establish our place in the world, to find a kind of meaning that separated us from this notion that we simply are born, we live, and then we die, and we, you know, go back to the earth. The sort of thing that we see happening with animals. And I think a lot of these ideas were driven by the need to establish that kind of sense of humans being special. So it was that was driving it. Psychology, really, rather than any kind of science.
So you also write that it's a large sweep of history here, while this change is happening, this big change. But there were people all through that didn't adopt these ideas. And these tended to be people who were close to animals, owned animals, worked with animals.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a complex picture, because what I'm painting here is this sort of establishment approach, the intellectuals, the philosophers, the theologians. Apart from that, people who actually worked with animals, who owned animals, they tended to think very differently about them. They tended to consider them as part of the same moral community. And there are many examples in history. I mean, one of the strangest, really, is the frequency of animal trials in the Middle Ages. It was quite common for example, pigs who killed children, which actually happened quite a lot because pigs used to roam the streets in medieval times. A pig who had killed a child would often be brought before a criminal court and tried. And the pig would be represented by a human lawyer who would put its case. Usually what would happen is the the pig would be convicted and condemned to death and would then be hung, you know, from a rope, from a tree, in a very similar way to human death, human convictions. And there are cases, in fact, of animals being dressed in the clothes of men before they were hung. And this is a sort of, this sounds very, very strange, but it just is a demonstration of how, for many people, perhaps, you know, the regular people, animals and humans were considered to have a similar sort of behavioral motivation to be responsible for their own actions. Very different to the idea that you find in theology at that time.
There's another place that this shows up is in folk tales, children's literature. What does that say?
Well, children are an interesting subject in this regard, because when they are very young, it seems that they don't really distinguish between humans and non-humans. And as they learn to speak, they expect to be able to speak to other animals and for other animals to speak back to them. Children dream about animals a lot more than adults do. So for a child, an animal is something that much more on their level. And of course, this idea is reflected in children's books. I mean, the idea of speaking animals or animals that can communicate with humans or humans that become animals or hybrid animal-human creatures are very, very common in children's books. And for children, they are entirely believable.
So what's the, I guess the main harm you would say is with this view, the separation from animals, we're exceptional. That also separates us from nature, does it? It creates this big separation, which is, I guess you would say, harmful.
I think it is about a separation of humankind from the rest of the natural world. The idea that we are somehow outside of nature and superior in our abilities and qualities and our spirituality. And animals, the relationship with animals, that's where it has the most effect, I suppose, because animals are used, exploited very obviously. But I think I think it comes down to this, again, this constant search for human meaning. Where do we fit in? Where do we fit into the world? And it's been easy to try and imagine ourselves as somehow outside the rest of nature. We have our special place. But it's a bit of a fabrication, and particularly the latest scientific findings suggest so.
What if we narrow that gap, that division, as you're suggesting we probably ought to consider, what can we learn from animals? I guess one thing I guess you would say is observe the animals around us more closely. What do we learn?
You can learn a lot by observing animals closely. I mean, one obvious thing is just how attentive they are to what's going on around them. How instinctually they live in the moment, and how clever they are at adapting to their changing environments. I mean, we all often talk about human intelligence, we measure human intelligence as how effectively people can adapt to change in their environments. Well, animals tend to do that all the time. Their ecosystems, their environments are very different to ours, but they tend to be very well adapted to them. So I think we can learn a lot about that just from watching them.
By the way, do you writing this book, doing this work, has that changed your? Do you have a pet? Has that changed your relationship to the animals around you?
Well, I have a cat who actually, as we've been speaking, has been trying to force its way onto onto my lap, and cats, I find cats fascinating because you generally never know what their intention is, what, you know, what's going on in their mind. And this is the thing about looking at animals, observing animals. It's difficult to know what is in their minds, what their intentions are. But you could also say that about other humans. Humans can be very opaque, and yet we can relate to them, even without that deep knowledge. But writing this book, I obviously spent a lot of time looking at how people think about animals, how people behave towards animals. And one thing I noticed that it's often the case that we don't treat animals as individuals. I'm not talking about our pets, but just thinking about animals in the wild. You see a deer in a field, and often that's a deer. It's part of its species, and we think about that population, but it's harder to think about individual animals as individual beings. And I think if we manage to shift that perspective and to consider animals as individuals in the same way that we consider humans as individuals, then it becomes easier to sort of imagine how they might be living their lives and to relate to them in a different way.
You write that animals are like different nations to each other. It's like having a different language, right? But they're definitely trying to interact.
Yeah, that's actually not my metaphor. That's from it's common to Indigenous American communities. This idea of different types of animals being different nations, as if they were different communities of people. We can't necessarily directly communicate with them, but we can have that kind of respect. I think that's an interesting way of thinking about animals, other animals not being like us, hard to figure out what's going on in their minds, but still very possible to empathize with them.
So I guess there's a spectrum here. There are people who, you know, don't care at all and are happy in the division, all the way to maybe on the other end of the spectrum are, do you call them Therians? People who feel that they maybe should have been animals. Tell me about this.
Yeah, these are people who they seemingly mostly born or develop at an early age. The sensation of being some kind of other species, so they may sense that they have fur instead of skin, or that then their nose and mouth take the form of a sort of snout, or that they have a tail. And they grow up with this, not really understanding what it is. I came across this community through a couple of psychologists who I was talking to about something else. And they were describing to me this group who they were studying and questioning. And it's not understood, you know, but it's completely accepted in psychology that this can happen. Therians spend a lot of their lives trying to figure out why they feel the way they feel. And of course, it's very difficult for them to tell other people about this because they're often subject to ridicule and mocked. They can really only talk about it to other Therians. But I mean, I've actually got to know quite a few of them in many different countries. And it's more common than you might imagine.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back much more with Michael Bond. We're talking about his new book called Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with acclaimed science writer Michael Bond. His new book, interesting book, is called Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. Mike Bond, I want to get into talking about the latest science in animal sentience and the latest studies. But first of all, one key thing you put in the book is the discovery that human visual system evolved to be more acutely sensitive to living things. We evolved. We still have this, even though most of us don't use this.
Yeah, this is a sort of neural mechanism that clearly evolved in our ancient ancestors, who were living among animals and depending on them, interacting with them day to day. And it's a sort of fast track system that links the visual system, the visual cortex, with the emotional part of the brain, the amygdala. So any sight or sense that there might be an animal present, that produces a very, very fast emotional response, quicker than you're capable of actually consciously being visually aware of it. And this evolved because individuals in that ancestral environment who were quick and effective at spotting animals in the environment, they would have been more likely to survive and reproduce. And so this trait became a universal characteristic among human beings. And it's sort of surprising that it is still with us today, because we're no longer in those environments. We don't tend to require that instant reflex. But experiments have shown that we are still capable of it. It's still with us.
So we earlier in the program, you outlined how this big division happened. I wonder maybe you just briefly tell us the relationship people would have had with animals in the Ice Age before this big division took hold.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's quite hard to know for sure, because there's so little surviving evidence. We're talking about, you know, going back 40,000 years. But clearly at that time, so between 40,000 and 10,000 years ago, the latter part of the Ice Age, our ancestors would have lived very closely with animals, would have been surrounded by them, hunted them for food, depended on them for food, but also would have had to evade them, because there were a lot of big predators in the landscape at that time. And a lot of the animals at that time are no longer living. So you have this sort of the big woolly mammoths, the woolly rhinoceroses. I'm talking in the European landscape, and various kinds of bear, cave lion. So it was a dangerous environment. But from what we know, the only cultural evidence that exists are these cave paintings. And the artists tended to paint the sort of dramatic, the big, the dangerous animals, rather than the animals that they were eating, which was largely reindeer and other kinds of deer. So they were obviously impressed by these animals, and the style with which they painted them suggests that they were reverential about them. There were also, these paintings are very detailed, and they depict some very closely observed anatomical characteristics of the animals, which suggests that the artists observed them very closely and were very knowledgeable about them.
Let's bring it up to today. Tell me about the latest science on animal sentience. A lot of work being done here.
Uh-huh, sure. Well, now you find that most neuroscientists will argue that all vertebrates and many invertebrates have some kind of consciousness. It used to be thought that consciousness was something that only humans possess, the awareness of ourselves, of our own existence. But it seems that that is a pretty widespread phenomenon in the rest of the animal world. I mean, in some ways, it would be strange if other animals didn't have consciousness, because to be aware of your existence is important for survival. There's also been many experiments on animal intelligence, and biologists have found that other great apes and many birds, particularly crows, rooks and jays, and octopus and other animals have a kind of intelligence that we would never have imagined, say, 30, 40 years ago. For example, crows and rooks are capable of raising the level of water in a jar in order to bring within their reach a floating treat. You know, they work out that you have to put stones in the water. Now, that's the sort of thing that, you know, most 6-7-year-old human children are not capable of doing. Octopuses have a very strange kind of intelligence. They're capable of doing all kinds of things, even in a lab, interacting with their human keepers. They can recognize different human lab workers, even if they're wearing the same clothes. This kind of thing. Emotions are another area. It's now almost certain that other primates and most other vertebrates have some kind of emotional systems. Again, it'd be surprising if they didn't, because emotions are rooted in the body. And like us, they all have bodies and they interact with their environments. So there are many aspects of animal behavior and cognition that have sort of become apparent just in the last 20 years.
What changes should that provoke in us then, do you think, this new understanding?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think it could change, it should change perhaps the way we treat animals. If you understand that an animal can suffer the same way that you can, feel pain, suffer emotionally, or have a kind of intelligent understanding of the world around it, that might change the way we treat them.
I was reading an interview where you said, working on this book, you started dreaming about fantastical animals. Tell me about that. That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I can't really explain it, but I began to have these strange dreams of animals that you wouldn't really find in nature. So vast insects and very frightening sort of predators. And it was quite entertaining. I just sort of in my dream life found myself sort of in this world, almost a prehistoric make-believe world. There's been a lot of research on how people dream and the presence of animals in dreams. It's pretty much all speculative. So I don't really have any great insight as to why I personally had those dreams.
Through much of our history, we've had mythological beings. I guess filtering animals through fears, through other emotions.
Yeah, mythological beings have been a constant source of fascination. Monsters, hybrid beings, frightening human animal creatures. I mean, these are present in mythology going back thousands of years. You know, the great myth of Beowulf is one example, and every country, every nation has its own mythology, and mythological animals tend to form part of it. It's possibly because at the time when the sort of intellectual establishment and theological establishment considered animals separate to humans in arts and literature and other aspects of our culture, this is where we really had permission to explore that boundary between animals and humans, the sort of interspecies boundary. And I think that's how these creatures exist freely in mythology, because people are fascinated by it, by this idea that perhaps the boundary between species is not as robust as we tend to believe. The idea that we can perhaps become another animal, or that we have aspects, we share aspects with other animals, has been a source of fascination for ages, and that comes out in this literature, in the literature of mythology.
You wrote, I think this is profound, you say, without other animals, we can hardly be human. What are you saying there?
What I meant was the idea of humans existing alone in the world, or of humans having a singular importance in the world, is somehow a sort of tragic idea. It's not something that should make us feel comfortable. The idea that we are apart from nature, outside of it, above it, you know, it feels, that disconnect feels lonely, and it just doesn't feel like a good place for humanity to be. So that's the idea I was getting at.
I found this in an article you wrote, What Can We Learn About Ourselves from Animals? You kind of do a literary survey, right, of especially humans trying desperately to imagine what it's like to be an animal. I wonder if you'd talk about that a little bit. You start in this article with Thomas Nagel. What is it like to be a bat? He concludes, I want to know what it's like to be for a bat to be a bat. He said he can imagine maybe himself being a bat, but he wants to know what it's like for a bat to be a bat, and he finds that hard to get to.
Yeah, and it does sound hard to get to get into the mind of another creature, but I find that this subject is interesting because so many people have really tried to sort of feel what it's like and to exist in the world of other creatures. There's an English writer who spent some time trying to be a badger, literally living in a burrow and sort of dressing like a badger. And then he tried to be, I think it was a swift, and he constructed this kind of microlite thing that give him the feeling of flying. And there are many examples of writers who have written about what it might be like to be a hawk. Those sort of, you know, raptors are particularly attractive to people, that idea of being a top predator. And there's a recent book, H's for Hawk, which is very popular in the UK, possibly in the US as well. And that's Helen MacDonald tried to see the world through the eyes of a hawk. So these are all valiant attempts. And they usually provide their subject with considerable psychological angst, I would say, because stepping outside of your human self and into the world of another creature, it can be disconcerting and confusing. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but it's a fascinating subject. Yeah,
I want to read part of what you wrote on Helen MacDonald, H's for Hawk. So she describes how owning and living with the goshawk, a bird that's fascinated her since childhood, took her to the very edge of being human, and then to somewhere where I wasn't human at all. She says, gave her the perspective she craved. But then the experience turned out to be so alien, so contrary to human regard, nearly drove her mad. That was the idea. She went to the edge and I guess didn't experience, sounds like, what she wanted to.
I don't know what she was expecting, but it does make you think, you know, what is a species? We talk about species and the very defined barrier between different species, but that some biologists will tell you that that's a fairly flimsy construct anyway, because I mean, for example, one of the rules of species is that different species are not supposed to be able to breed with each other, but that happens in so many cases. Wolves and coyotes, and going back, members of our own genus, other human families, the Homo sapiens bred with Neanderthals. So that's, you're crossing the species boundary there. I think just when you are on the edge of that idea, it just can be disconcerting because we don't have any experience of it, and we don't tend to think about animals in that way. So when we do step into, we straddle the boundary, we try and see the world how other animals see it. I think it can often be quite alarming, albeit educational.
You say you asked several friends, 30 friends, you say, if they've ever fantasized about changing species. Many of them had fantasized about that. What kinds of species did they bring up?
I was quite surprised. You know, I haven't got the list in front of me, and I can't exactly remember, but there were a lot of, there were lions. So there were a lot of obvious, impressive species people wanted to be. Being a bird is sort of a common affectation. But I guess what surprised me is that people had thought about this. So many people had thought about this. Mm-hmm. It was like a sort of straw poll among my friends. And I think the world of other animals is endlessly fascinating to people beyond their own pets.
Yeah, I could understand many of these. Several said cats for their independence.
Sure.
You mentioned lion, horses, wildness and speed. One said a koala for its climbing skills. Another said golden jackal for its omnivorous taste. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting exercise. Just one more from this, and then we'll take a break and discuss more from the book. You mentioned this article, a friend who had lost his wife to cancer and a robin who came and visited. This was a very touching interaction.
Yeah, this was a gentleman who obviously went through this tragic loss of his wife. Prior to that, there was this robin who used to come and visit them and feed out of his hand. And then that continued. The next generation of robin, the offspring of that original robin, continued to visit him after his wife had died, and also accompanied him when he visited his wife's grave, which was just up there in the churchyard up the street. And it's hard to explain how that happened, but for what was interesting to me was the effect that had on my friend, and how that brought considerable comfort, the interest from this other creature who he couldn't speak with, but somehow there was communication, perhaps empathy.
We are talking with writer Michael Bond. His book is Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. That's out and available now. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access U Time. Tom Williams. We have with us for the hour Michael Bond, who previously is the author of Wayfaring, The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. The new book is Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. That's out and available now. Michael Bond, you've said that you're fascinated. You tend to come back to and write about liminal states, boundaries, those mysteries that are in the boundaries. This is asking you to, I guess, psychologize yourself, but why do you think you're fascinated by those liminal states?
Well, I've never been asked that before. I'm not sure, but actually that's how I came originally to this book. I was just looking at the sort of boundaries of inhuman lives where people perhaps struggle in those areas. It could be a boundary between youth and adulthood, the boundary between humans and animals. Is one that has been discussed for, through history, thousands of years. It just seems to me that those liminal states are very creative places. They're full of doubt, often fear. They can be threatening. What were you just talking about? The way you reach across the boundary from human to another species. There's a scent of danger there. because it starts to disrupt the idea that we have of ourselves, who we are, what it is to be a human. Once you're in those liminal states, you can't help but question all of that. So it just makes for fascinating thought, I guess.
I imagine one of the fun parts of writing a book like this is the research and the people you meet. I wonder if you could tell me about a couple of the most fascinating people you met, interviewed for this book.
Yeah, I mean, well, some of the most fascinating we touched on, the Therians, the people who live this life that you never really hear about, who feel the physical sensations of other species. So I spent a lot of time with them, perhaps a disproportionate amount of time. But there's also, I mean, one person who comes to mind is one of the guides in the caves, where the Ice Age art is in Southern Europe. He guided thousands of people over 20, 30 years. And he had such knowledge of the cave, but also never tired, it seemed, of imagining what life was like for our ancestors 30,000 years ago. And so he kind of lived an alternate life, if you like, in that cave, imagining the artist who created the art. And then there's actually a place near me, an animal hospital, who they treat wild animals that have been injured, a lot of hedgehogs, but also injured birds, animals that are injured on the road. And the sort of dedication of those people, and also their interaction with members of the public, and their attempts to sort of educate people about the behavior of wild animals. I find that interesting. So yeah, there's no shortage of fascinating people in the research.
What's your favorite animal?
I'm not sure I really have one, but I'm always fascinated by deer, because they are so sort of perceptually intelligent and responsive to anything that's going on. I think I would, if I were to be another animal, it would probably be a migratory bird of some kind, because they have qualities that humans don't, such as the ability to navigate by the Earth's magnetic field, or filtering out different smells that pigeons do. So plugging into that kind of ability would be fascinating. But I don't know. Yeah, a favorite animal that's a hard one.
Just have a couple minutes left here. What do you recommend? What do you want people to? I guess, first of all, what to take away from the book, and then anything you would recommend that people do to observe animals or interact with animals differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think mainly this is an exercise in thinking, and firstly, to sort of understand how we have come to think about animals in the way that we do, and consider the history of that, and consider how it's driven by our own psychology, our own need for meaning. Also to consider how the way we look at animals, we brought that into how we relate to each other. So the kind of linguistic metaphors that we use towards animals, that idea of separateness, we use to describe people who we don't understand, or groups who are different to us. You know, people use animal as a sort of an insult very often, or vermin, or beast. You know, those kind of words have crept into our language and the way we describe each other. So this is not just about how we treat other species, it's also how we treat outgroups, people who we mistrust. And so it's really, an opportunity to consider how our psychology works, how we treat outsiders, because animals really are the sort of ultimate other, if you like.
Well, fascinating book, interesting discussion. We've been talking with Michael Bond, and the new book is out and available now, Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. Michael Bond, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom. Much enjoyed it.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.